And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
If only animals could write their own sonnets and soliloquies, how much richer we might all be. To feel the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, to take up arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep no more, and by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to be or not to be. That is the question when your voice of the earth continues anon.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Well, I'm no Hamlet, nor am I a Richard Burton. And certainly we seem not to have a Shakespeare in our midst, although perhaps we could use one. It's amazing that 500 years ago, the bard could so skillfully express the myriad complexities of the realm, from the flatulence of Falstaff to the cunning of King Henry IV. Imagine for a moment that someone in this, our global stage, could tell our tale of power and intrigue, cunning and greed, cruelty and the headlong race to the witch's brew of double-double, toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble. A metaphor for climate change? Someone to show us the loneliness of the barren soul as the great and spirited friends who have sustained and nourished our lives, the wild horses tamed and borne us to the ends of the earth, the wolves, which became the man's best friend, the dog, which honors even the tramp and the clown, the birds, which awaken our days with joy and regaling, the butterflies, who kiss our sodden eyes, and the horse and the wolf and the mockingbird and monarch find their place in the grand stage of life, rewritten and written off, as the new actors in this global play perform only for profit, power, and property. To be or not to be takes on new meaning as we hear the mystery of the disappearance of bees across the nation and around the world. Where are they going and why? We ask that question in segment 2. To be or not to be is also the question of life itself these days, as we witness the accelerating race to extinction of hundreds and thousands of the lead and bit players known as the balance of nature. In segment 3, we visit the Center for Biological Diversity, dedicated to bringing awareness to the plight of the endangering populations of whales and wolves, frogs and fowl, of every color, dimension, shape, and form. Something's coming. Yes, something's coming. But it's obscured in the mists of the warming oceans, lost in the silence of the plundered woods, beyond the reach, perhaps, of even a dream much longer. I say no more, no more. But first, the news. Beekeepers from around the nation are reporting a sudden and significant disappearance of bees from working hives. At this time, there is no explanation for this development, which seems to be a general decline. Bees play a critical role in helping to pollinate food crops, and the reports, which cite losses ranging from 40% to 80% in the population of colonies, the impact on our food supply may be felt in the months ahead. We will be covering this story during the second segment of today's show. Japan's Fisheries Agency's Far Seas Division, which conducts and sponsors the annual Japanese whale hunt, purportedly for scientific research, has officially called off the winter hunt in the Antarctic waters, due in large part to the direct confrontations by sea shepherds Farley Mowat, Robert Hunter, and the Greenpeace vessels, which resulted in a collision of whales and ships recently in the Antarctic seas. Adding to Japan's whale fleet woes was a fire aboard the Nishin Mara, which crippled the ship, and threatened to develop into a toxic spill off the coast of one of Antarctica's primary penguin nesting and breeding sites. One Japanese sailor died as a result of the fire, which is not blamed on the anti-whaling actions. The Nishan Mara has been put into order and is steaming away and hopes to serve as the factory ship during the spring whale harvest scheduled for May in the Northwest Pacific. The winter hunt had hoped to harvest 860 whales, but was only successful in killing 508. Without a full harvest of whales, Japanese consumers could be looking at much higher prices for whale in its many forms in Japanese restaurants and food stores, where ultimately the catch ends up, to help pay for the return of the research vessels each year to the Antarctic waters for the hunt. Japan is only one of a handful of nations which encourage whaling, claiming eating whale flesh is part of their culture. Most of the rest of the world is abiding by the international ban on commercial whaling, which went into effect in the 1980s. 8,000 gallons of the toxic substance cumene spilled into the Ohio River between Illinois and Kentucky when the barge ferrying the liquid hit a brick wall and ruptured. Cumene, also called isopropyl benzene, is used in the manufacture of chemicals such as phenol and acetone and can cause serious irritation when breathed. Direct contact by animals can cause damage to most animal life. Despite such realities, owners of the barge, Houston-based Kirby Inland Marine, assured neighboring residents between Brookport and Metropolis that there would not be a risk to human health. Meanwhile, Kentucky and Illinois officials are closing highways, bridges, and parks that could be affected by the spill. Shell Oil Company is making plans to act quickly on leases it purchased permitting offshore oil exploration and drilling in the Beaufort Sea, which splashes its waves directly along ANWR, the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. The efforts by Shell Oil are part of a strategy to establish drilling for oil on public lands, even if those lands are only a few miles offshore from the wildlife refuge. Exploration offshore will involve the use of the stunning sonic guns, which are used to map underground rock formations, which help in determining potential sites where oil may be located. Whales and other animals which live and migrate through these waters could be soundly impacted by such actions, which can lead to temporary dislocation and even death from ruptured eardrums, which whales and dolphins use for sonic echolocation and navigation. As well, potentials for oil spills, always high in these rough seas, would be greatly increased and pose a threat to the millions of birds, mammals, and fish whose presence is the whole purpose of a national wildlife refuge. Shell hopes to begin its drilling campaign this summer. Household lights are going off all across Europe and will be completely darkened by 2010 in an effort to reduce global warming. The incandescent lights that will be banned will be replaced by fluorescent and LED lighting, which operates at about one-fifth the energy consumption of regular incandescent bulbs. Australia, too, is banning incandescent bulbs and will finish their transition within 3 years. Meanwhile, GE announced it will introduce a new line of energy-efficient incandescent bulbs by 2010. Critics claim this sounds a bit too much like the American auto manufacturer's slow response to efficiency in cars, which already has led to the dramatic decline of the American auto industry. Could someone point this out to GE? Please. Dow Jones Venture One announced that investment in the clean tech sector had doubled during 2006 over the previous year's investments. Total global investment in clean tech ventures reached $1.28 billion in 2006. Of this, nearly $884 million came from U.S. venture investments. The largest investments were made to solar panel manufacturers as well as other renewable energy sources such as wind. The future for venture investments in the cleantech sector is projected to remain bullish as the world grapples with the challenges of global warming and a now certain end to limitless oil-based energy. And finally, researchers have, for the first time, documented the use by chimpanzees of spears to hunt small mammals. 22 incidents have been reported in which female and immature chimps break off limbs, strip off the branches, chew on the ends to fashion a point, then thrust them into tree cavities in what is believed to be an effort to injure, kill, and eat other mammals. The chimps, without exception, violently thrust the pointed stick into a hole, then pull it out, sniff it, and taste it for signs of a hunted victim's scent. Although so far only one case of an actual successful bush baby kill was witnessed, scientists cannot say whether the animal was already dead or was injured or killed by the hunting chimpanzee. Future science behaviorists warn that as chimps and similar species are pushed further up against the wall of human expansion, they may evolve abilities to craft even more elaborate weapons, which could include harpoons, bazookas, fighter jets, and even cruise missiles. Humans are encouraged to take every precaution to give the chimps enough breathing room to prevent this possible response by humans' closest link. And that's the news. And a few reminders. In the weeks ahead, listeners are advised that something's coming. And that's all we can say right now. This past weekend, the world was abuzz with the Oscars. Lots of amazing films this year, from the reminiscent goodliness of Dysfunctional Love and Little Miss Sunshine, to the unique vision of globalization captured in Babel, and then, of course, the usual blood, guts, and rage of the Hollywood blockbusters. But Al Gore was there, and I think he needs to learn to be himself a bit more, even when receiving an Oscar for Best Documentary and being recognized for inspiring the best song by Melissa Etheridge's I Need to Wake Up. We are waking up a bit, and we are now gearing up for the great 2008 presidential election, and it's everything from messy to messianic. But if we've learned nothing else, we should know by now that democracy matters. That who is our leader has real consequence to us at a very, very personal level. That our future and the dream of a world of peace rests to choosing a real leader. It's a tough job, President. I take it seriously. I think it matters. I think it's time we wake up. And that's why, before Al Gore was the media godfather that he's quickly becoming, before Inconvenient Truth was megaplexed, way back in March of 2006, well, here's what I had to say then. 2008 is an election year, and we have the right and the responsibility to choose a new president. It's really no secret that George Bush spends a little too much time in his Oval Office and would perhaps be a better overall president if he got out a little more, mingled with the people, and spent more time taking long walks along some of America's great trails, perhaps a wilderness trail or some quality time in one of our national parks. 2008 will give him, finally, the rest he needs to sort things out. And it will also give us the great hope and opportunity to choose a new president, to change course, chart a new path, renew our visions and hopes with a fresh start, if we are wise. Or, of course, we could once again let ourselves be bamboozled by yet another tried-and-true red-blooded politician who will carry on the status quo, leading us farther along the path of exploring the wonders in the quest of new sources of oil and generating economic security for those heavily invested in exploitative industries that take from the earth without renewing and give to those who have the most. 2008 will be a test of democracy. The democracy that we shed our blood and the blood of others to promote in the name of a dying neoconic quest for security for the existing theocracy. Or, we the people may reach deep into the soul of our nation's great legacy to honor the wisdom entrusted to the people in a Declaration of Independence and its Bill of Rights. Democracy, America, the voice of the people, the voice of the earth. There is something real and significant about all this, if we take the time to think at all. It's a whole new world, and America is dying for leadership, or better yet, for a lack thereof. And over the past year, I've heard a voice, quite literally a voice, that speaks clearly and boldly and forcefully and wisely. And each time he speaks, I feel something real being said, in a way I've wanted to hear. He's a warrior, tested by fire, attacked and throttled, bullied and smeared, and ultimately vanquished in 2000, or more accurately, victorious but with a catch. The great 537 vote defeat of Al Gore as determined by one vote of our Supreme Court. He took the outcome like a man, and in his wisdom he has reflected as great men do. And he's grown in stature, in strength, and in statesmanship. And he speaks of a democracy of old that will serve the democracy of now, if we are up to it. And he speaks of the sense that something is going so terribly wrong in America today. And he speaks of the urgent need to grasp the reins of power as the people, so that we may again regain our way, because now, more than ever, as global warming, mass extinction, the emergence of China and India, and a depleted oil future become the world of tomorrow, we either apply our greatness today or lose the blessings of a true democracy in the world forever. And it is because Al Gore speaks so clearly to me, and because he talks as a leader must at times like this, that I commit my efforts to Al Gore for president in 2008. I'm not waiting. We can't wait. I don't expect many people to at this time understand my stance, but I ask in the days and years ahead that when Al Gore speaks, you take the time to listen. With everyone now focused on the 2008 election, with only a year and a half left, there's a lot of buzz in Washington about the fumbling and bumbling leading up to the change of the guard. But in other parts of the nation, there's much less buzz flying around. It's all about bees, the bumbly kind, when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Probably the last time you thought much about honeybees was last week when Donald Trump rewarded the winning apprentices with a chance to visit a Sioux Bee honey ranch and harvest honey from a hive. And it's a good thing they had that chance, because there's a lot of buzz on the street that bees are just plain disappearing. We're off to Georgia to find out what all the buzz, or lack thereof, is all about, and the very real consequences it may have on us all, when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. There's a lot of things in life that we take for granted that we should pay more attention to, but one that we probably don't pay that much attention to are bees. We only, if they kind of are in our face, do we pay much attention to them. I was playing tennis the other day, and there was a dying bee on the tennis court, and I thought, geez, I wonder what I should do with the bee. But anyways, I don't think about bees all that much. But bees are suddenly appearing in the news, a bit of a buzz in the news, as a matter of fact, about bees, because, first of all, they carry such a tremendous responsibility in providing us so much of our food in terms of what they do, but as well, there's now an emerging story that says that a lot of the bee population is disappearing. And to help us understand, first of all, the role of bees and also what's happening, is the executive director of the American Beekeeping Federation, Troy Foer. He's talking to us from Georgia. Troy, welcome to the Wild Side News.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Have you been a beekeeper yourself? I have to imagine you were.
I grew up in beekeeping. My father was a beekeeper, and then about 15 years ago, I became executive director of the American Beekeeping Federation, so I spend my time pretty much doing this now.
Bees play an enormous role in our culture and actually our life, and yet a lot of people don't know about that. Why don't you explain the really significant relationship of bees to our life?
Well, of course, the reason we have bees is to pollinate plants, blooms, and generally you think of food plants. Everything is, as I say, from almonds to zucchini. It's been said that honeybees contribute their pollination, through their pollination, they contribute one-third of our diet. So they say every third spoonful that you eat, theoretically, is a honeybee is responsible for that.
Well, as part of that, then, would be, if we look around the nation, are there areas where there's more bees than others?
Yes. When I first got into beekeeping, the driving factor was honey production, and to a large extent, for many beekeepers, it still is. But so beekeepers congregated in areas where they could produce big crops of honey. And a given beehive in a good area like this will produce, you know, on average, 125, 150 pounds of honey, depending on the year. Mostly that depends on the weather. But now over my lifetime in bees, my career, there's been a continuing emphasis more on use of bees for pollination. And now it's largely due to the almond crop in California. Many more beekeepers are more involved in pollination than they were earlier. And for many, pollination is the largest part of their income from their bees.
That's very interesting. In essence, this is the new migrant worker bees that are so important for our food. So this is something I didn't know. I really didn't know that there literally are people who make their living by transporting their beehives into areas where they're required for pollination.
Well, this can be as small as a beekeeper putting two or three or four or five hives on the back of a pickup truck and, you know, and taking them to a neighbor's farm to pollinate his apple trees, or it can be, you can up to putting 400 or 500 beehives onto a semi and covering them up with a net and trucking them from as far as from the East Coast to California. More frequently, more typically, would be from Texas or somewhere in the Mississippi Valley area to California.
That's fascinating. So if a person shows up with a beehive, obviously they have to be there at the right time for the pollination to occur properly. What kind of a time frame would a colony spend in any particular location?
I think usually we're talking about 3 weeks for most crops, and it may be a month or 5 weeks. It depends on the crop. I mean, some crops will bloom continually, and the farmers will pick the fruit, and then the plant will put out more fruit. You know, it'll be a succession. I'm thinking watermelons and crops like that, but like for almonds, I think it's about a 3 week bloom for most of the varieties, and you have to be there right when the time is right. And as soon as they're at 3 weeks or whatever's over, they have to get the bees out of the orchards so that the farmers can apply pesticide sprays to take care of pests, because you can't spray things like that when the honeybees are there to kill them.
Well, that's fascinating. So you bring in perhaps even in some cases hundreds of hives, and these bees must be very much associated with that specific hive then. Is that right?
Oh, yes. They're, you know, when we were kids in school, we had all these absolutes we were taught, and one of the absolutes I was taught was that all the bees return to the same hive every night, but that's not exactly true, but most of them do.
Hmm.
By and large, a bee will go out and do her work and then return to that same hive again and again during the day and at night.
So that's fascinating. So even if they're moving from location to location, it really is that hive that they're coming back to. They somehow have an awareness of their home.
That's right. And when you put several hundred on a truck and cover them with a net and truck them for a couple of days, there's, you know, more mixture than you would want, but in the end, you set them all down and spread them out in a orchard or wherever, and they soon reorient themselves to where they are and come back to the hive that they belong to.
Now, in terms of the whole industry, there are obviously some hives that probably are in a spot and have been there for 20 or 30 years, and then there are those that are these migrating hives. Any idea of what the mix is there?
We don't have a lot of good numbers for beekeepers, but as time goes on, as I said, there's more people involved in pollination. As you become more involved in pollination, you have to be mobile. So they'll have a four or six beehives on a pallet, much like a freight pallet, and pick them up with some sort of forklift and stack them up on a truck. It's just like you see people loading lumber or something at a lumber yard.
So you probably have to do that at night when they're in their hives or something
like
that?
It's best to do it late in the day, and if you can, and unload them early in the morning. But it doesn't always work that way with schedules, but that's the best way to do it. Next probably is there are approximately 2,000 commercial beekeepers in the country. You know, people who, that's their main revenue for their life, their income. And I would say out of those, there are probably more than half of them haul their bees around for either for honey or pollination. Put honey and pollination together is probably, it's probably a good bit more than half. It's probably two-thirds or more. But now some people say they'll have bees like in their main area for honey production, let's say, would be like, say, Minnesota. And then they may go to Texas in the fall where it's warmer climate and the bees have a longer season to work. More flowers are bloom longer into the fall. And then they'll get them ready, and they may ship them from Texas then out to California to do almonds. And then they may either go back to Texas or may go directly to back to Minnesota then to make honey.
Now, is the honey process, the bees making honey all the time, or is there kind of a season for honey making for bees?
Well, it's bees usually, most plants are, that bees work and make honey off of are springtime plants. Of course, now spring comes later in the year as you go further north, so it's not unusual for a beekeeper to, say, have in, Florida, make orange blossom honey for this time of year in March. And then maybe in late May, he'll have them in North Florida working various kinds of wildflowers, and then they'll truck them on to the Dakotas, let's say, for summer as the season progresses north.
The source of the honey, like you mentioned, honey, orange blossom honey,
right,
which has its own unique flavor and character.
Orange blossom very much does, yes.
Then from the time that you open those bees up to pollinating the orange fields, how long does it take for those bees to produce a crop of honey? And then you have to harvest. What's that time frame there?
Usually in the orange groves, you're talking about 6 weeks that you would have them in the orange groves, and they would produce the honey and cure the honey out and have it where you could harvest it. So, and then you harvest that honey, and then you move them to another location, and they'll produce some other kind of honey.
And they just seem to take to this process of continually having to reinvent their lifestyle.
Yes.
Yeah, very
and
interesting.
When you go in a grocery store and you see honey labeled clover or orange blossom or tupelo or whatever, that means a beekeeper has taken that honey away from that colony. We call it surplus honey. So beekeepers put boxes on a hive, and the bees put honey in it, and they take that surplus then away. At the end of that, we call it a honey flow, at the end of the orange blossom honey flow or the end of the clover honey flow.
Very interesting.
And they keep it separate that way so they can market individual flavors.
Well, now, the story that's making the news right now is the fact that beekeepers almost nationally are suddenly noticing that there's a very serious decline in their populations.
Well, this really came into our attention in November when one particular beekeeper who moves up and down the East Coast from Florida to Maine and New York and Pennsylvania, wherever pollination crops or honey crops are, he had some bees that he had moved to Florida. He moves his headquarters, so to speak, his family south then in the winter too. So they went out to look at some bees, 400 hives, and they started opening them up and looking, and just hive after hive was just empty. Now, I should point out, you hear, I may be mixing them too. We say beehives, and we also say colonies. The beehive is the box that beekeepers put the colony in. The colony is the family of bees that might be there. So he opens these different hives up, and there are no bees. And, of course, he was sort of dumbstruck by it all. He said he was speechless. And then he began to investigate and found that some other people were having similar situations. It was just a developing thing all of a sudden right then.
No.
As time has gone on, more beekeepers have found this situation. That I guess the kind of thing that's intriguing the public and mystifying the beekeepers and the beekeeping scientists is that the bees themselves are gone. They just, usually if you would have if you had a pesticide kill, let's say, you'd have all sorts of dead bees out in front of you, out in front of your beehive. Like, you know, like you spray your room and you got roach problem, and you spray real heavy and you come in and there's roaches, you know, if it's that sort of thing, you follow me?
Sure.
So, but there's no bees out there, and the bees apparently flew away in some way and didn't return to the beehive. Many times there'll be just a small number of bees, and the queen will still be there, but you won't have the force of bees you would expect.
So the bees are just disappearing. They're disappearing into thin air of sorts.
More or less, that's right.
Huh. Has anyone been able to get any kind of handle on what's happening to them?
We've had a lot of people, particularly led by Penn State University, because several Pennsylvania beekeepers were first involved in this. They've taken a lot of samples as far as California, and now it's a kind of a laborious process of running the samples. So they're checking for all sorts of things. They're checking for pesticides. They're checking for pathogens. I mean, there are a number of diseases that bees have, and you know, even a healthy colony has some diseases you can find in it, and they're sort of in balance, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But they're looking for all these different things to see if they're something got out of balance and may have wiped out the colony.
Whereas this, in the past, has had some regional effect, it seems as if this is becoming much more of a national reality.
Now, we've had a couple of times in the past where we had a lot of reports of bee colonies dying this time of year and earlier in the year. But this is, I think there's more people involved and to a greater extent. I mean, we're talking about people who had 1,000 hives of bees and he had 40 left, I believe, alive.
40 hives left.
40 out of 1,000. I've heard of several people that had around 10,000 hives and they've lost maybe 80% of them.
Now, is this unique to this specific season, or has this ever happened before to this extent?
Well, of course, the bees, they have a life cycle in the colony, and what happens, the queen will be laying the eggs for the population of the hive, and then she tapers off as it begins to get late in the year, depending on where you are, but when it becomes close to winter. And then she'll quit, in general, except in places like South Florida. She quits laying eggs altogether, so the bees that are in the beehive, let's say, first of December, in more temperate climates, even like Georgia, those bees have to carry that colony over till springtime, till the queen starts laying again.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a period there when all you have is adult bees, old bees, so to speak. And they have to have enough longevity to go through until to start to cycle over again. Well, we have a number of things that have caused problems with this. Generally, the most recent things have been some parasitic mites that have been introduced in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And they shorten the longevity of bees. So if you have a long extended winter and your bees weren't, let's say, in too good a shape going into the winter, then you'll experience more colony mortality than you would have otherwise, than you would expect it. People see this from time to time, but this year it's just way more than people were expecting.
Well, now let's talk about the effect that this may have literally on our food sources in this upcoming year here, because we're heading into spring now, and suddenly this particular year, the bee population, particularly the bees that are being used for pollinating crops, what are people talking about in terms of what could happen to food crops?
Well, if I were a grower, let's say, of apples or some other crop that blooms early in the year, I would certainly be in contact with my beekeepers to make sure that they had enough, you know, bees to supply for my pollination needs. But as people go on later in the year, let's say watermelons or pumpkins or something like that, beekeepers will rebuild these colonies. They have, as a matter of routine maintenance of your operation or management of your bees, however you look at it, beekeepers build a lot of new colonies every spring anyway. So as the time goes on into the year, the numbers of colonies will increase and beekeepers will recoup their losses and be able to provide pollination services as well as produce honey. But the early crops will be suffering, both in terms of beekeepers being able to rent out their bees for pollination as well as beekeepers being able to produce honey on the early honey crops.
In some respects, it's good news for the beekeepers because they'll be able to charge more for their bees, but that's probably not what drives them necessarily. It probably is just a love affair with a way of life.
Well, this one beekeeper just told me that there's no way that no matter how good the year gets as it goes on, that he's going to be able to get out of the red because he's just had so many losses. And the people who have lost so much, so high a percentage, they just won't be able to do that. Short term, I don't think there's a lot. I hope there's not going to be a lot of fallout as far as pollination of food crops. Longer term, I think it will play into just the decisions of how many bee colonies should I run? Should I encourage my children and my grandchildren to become beekeepers? The general feeling that people had for the good life of being a beekeeper, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the longer term, if we can't really get a handle on this, it'll be detrimental to a lot of aspects of that.
Well, in cases where there haven't been bees to pollinate, people have tried different things to artificially pollinate. Talk about some of those.
Well, I'm not as familiar with those as I should be, but I do know that for different crops, there are some sprays that you can spray on them that will cause the plants to pollinate themselves. And you can also, some people who grow tomatoes may be familiar with this, you can use like a little paintbrush and transfer pollen from one blossom to another.
That's a lot of work.
There's nothing that can do it as efficiently as an insect. And for most crops, that's honeybees. Now, there are some other alternative insect pollinators and different crops use them to different degrees, but they're pretty specific. There's like a blueberry bee, there's a blue orchard bee that's they're working with and trying to pollinate almonds. There's some other solitary bees that pollinate like alfalfa. But if you're going to go out and you have a piece of land and you're going to grow a crop that needs pollination, there's no other replacement that you can get where you can get immediate supply and to do as good a job as if you rent honeybees from a beekeeper.
Well, possibly one of the solutions is for people to start looking into the craft of raising and keeping bees in their own neighborhoods and in their communities. If people wanted to learn more about how to do that and what's involved, what's the best way for them to find out?
Well, right now, this time of year, there are all over the country, there are people, community colleges and beekeeping clubs, county beekeeping clubs, state beekeeping associations, a variety of people that are holding bee schools, short courses we call them usually, and they may last a day or it may be five Saturdays in a row or whatever. But there are a lot of opportunities this time of year for people all across the country to learn about beekeeping, and it's really an interesting thing to do. I mean, you don't have to have a semi-truck, 10,000 hives of bees. You can just have one or two hives in your backyard, and it's really a very interesting, fascinating hobby.
Now, for people, let's say that someone wanted to do that. Of course, a lot of people are going to say, "Oh, well, I don't want all these bees around." What's life like living with bees in your backyard?
Well, I have half a dozen in my backyard. They're about 200 feet from my back door. They don't bother me. I see them around the water faucet time to time, gathering water, and I see them on the flowers pollinating, but. Of course, I grew up with them. That's a different thing, but they don't usually cause a problem. It's not a, particularly if you got any size lot at all. You could put them on the back of your lot, and you can even they're recommended practices that you can do so that they don't bother your neighbors or they don't go to your neighbor's swimming pool and things like that.
Well, here's the truth of the matter. I personally think that this is a wake-up call and that people might decide that they can watch less TV and possibly watch more about the bees, learn more about the bees and get involved in something like that. It's probably a wonderful way to spend your time and really accomplish something. And right now, it could be essential to help keep our food crops and our plant life around healthy across the nation.
Well, we appreciate the coverage, the articles, and the coverage like you're doing, and with people's interest. We've had, since this has been in the news, we've had any number of people have called here, just general public, what can we do? And we've had people send emails, and we certainly appreciate the concern and the interest that people have. And I think this is, like you said, a wake-up call. It very well could be, and it's so much nowadays people think that milk comes from the Safeway and whatever, and they don't have any. Every generation is further removed from the farm. And I think if people remember more where food does come from, and really remember also why you can buy things like grapes in the middle of the winter. You don't have to wait till grape season in California, whatever. To recognize that someone around the world is growing them and transporting them here. I think it's a better thing that we know more about all this.
Well, I'm doing everything I can to encourage people to relist with nature and the environment because it's the best thing that we could do with our lives. We really need to reconnect with the reality as opposed to so much fantasy and other whatever this thing is that we call life these days.
We also, the American Beekeeping Federation, a couple of years ago organized a research and education foundation where people can contribute to it to help us fund. Most of what we've done so far is funding graduate students in beekeeping and funding young people from programs to interest young people in beekeeping. But there are some other things. We're trying to get a website going, and if anyone is interested, they could look into that. It's honeybeepreservation.org. And they could look into that, and there's some resources there. And if people are interested, there's ways they could find out more about beekeeping. We'd like to help them any way we could.
Well, that's great, and I'll put that link on the show page for this show today. We've been talking with Troy Foer. He's the Executive Director of the American Beekeeping Federation. Their website is www.abfnet.org. Troy, thanks so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
It just may be that bees are a hard warning about global warming or mass extinction, or something we may not even yet have words for, kind of like Katrina was a wake-up call. But the story of the bees is really just a small part of a much larger truth, that we're witnessing some serious changes in animal well-being and diversity, and we'd best begin right now to listen. So stay tuned as we take a look at the new kind of wake-up call when your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
There's a lot of ways to think about a wake-up call, and that's what today's show is really all about. And in a moment, you're going to learn how you can get a wake-up call that sends a message every time your phone rings. It's all about diversity, and this is what it sounds like. Following on the topic of the show today, which has to do with what's happening to our various animal species around the world and in the nation here, we're all hearing about the fact that there are issues with global warming, that changes are happening in the environment, some of which are critical. Every time I hear what's happening, for example, to the chimpanzee populations, information coming from the Jane Goodall Institute and others, I just cringe. I hate to think of what has happened in my lifetime to the diversity of life on this planet. We are losing a lot of animals, and it is devastating to my soul, to be quite frank. These were my gifts. These were things that I adored and cherish. And unfortunately, as our population and our cultures and our global economies keep on growing, the animals are really taking a hit. Well, there's an organization that is really dedicated to bringing information forward about the critical need to maintain biological diversity. Nature Conservancy is one that really focuses on maintaining genetic integrity. But another one is the Center for Biological Diversity. And joining us now from California is Jeff Miller, who works with the center. Jeff, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sidney.
Well, let's talk about the Center for Biological Diversity.
Well, we're a nationwide conservation group that formed in the 1990s, actually started in the 1980s as a group focused on biodiversity and endangered species issues in the southwestern U.S. And in the 90s expanded and now are working to protect endangered species and their habitats throughout North America, and actually have recently started doing a lot of international conservation work as well. And we work to protect, mostly to protect endangered species and focus on their habitats and the ecosystems that support them. And we work through policy, through endangered species law, through public education, and through scientific work to promote the protection of biological diversity.
It's a huge topic, and let's start out by just having you give us a sense of what's happening to biological diversity. Really, is it something that we need to be concerned about right now? We're hearing more about it, but what is the state of the art?
Well, we're in the grips currently of an extinction explosion that's unprecedented in natural history. And although extinction's a natural phenomenon, current extinction rates are 100 to 10,000 times higher than natural background rates. And the current extinctions are definitely being brought about by humans. The other big change from some of the, you know, people have heard about the die off the dinosaurs or other extinctions. These extinctions are happening very quickly on a time scale where species cannot adapt and ecosystems can't adapt. The documented state of extinctions, the World Conservation Union looks at extinction, and they've documented 850 species extinct from the wild since 1500 AD. That's when scientific records began. But this doesn't account for thousands and thousands of species that are disappearing before they can be described by science. And if you look at what the status worldwide, there's currently over 16,000 species around the globe that are threatened with extinction, and that's with only about 3% of the world's species having been assessed. So literally tens to hundreds of thousands of species that are facing extinction. And with rapid climate change, with global warming brought about by human actions, we're looking at really an unprecedented wave of extinctions as the climate starts to change more rapidly than animals can and plants can adapt or move.
You know, a huge part of the problem is the fact that there is such an interrelationship between all these different animals and their habitats. And as these changes begin to accelerate, that interdynamic is, from my perspective, the one that scares me the most. We have no concept of the effects of the demise of certain animal species and the rippling effects that may have. Is anyone at this point beginning to get a handle on where that's headed?
No, but yeah, it is. I mean, some groups are trying to look at that, but it's, you know, obviously the natural world is a complicated system, and everything is interrelated. People have been telling us that for years, but I think we're getting to the point where, as we as humans start to feel some of the effects of losing some of these species, we're really going to start to understand that. And I noticed an article in the paper just yesterday that honeybees populations are vanishing around the country and actually around the world, and their star pollinators for our food crops are disappearing, and that's going to hit us hard, and that's when the biodiversity crisis is really going to hit home for people, is when we start to see our ecosystems unravel and the natural systems we depend on for food, for clean water, for breathable air, etc. start to fall apart.
I just got off the phone with the executive director of the American Beekeepers Federation.
Oh, okay.
Because it is, this is an indication of unique problems. This affects our food crops in so many different ways. But then there's just the larger spectrum of biological diversity. One is the kind of the science, the integrity of maintaining these living systems. But there's also another side. And how much are you able to really celebrate and discuss and bring forward the importance of just the wonder that this diversity provides to us?
Well, we definitely try to do that. I mean, all of us are involved in the kind of work we do because we're just in awe of the natural world, and you know, we draw a lot of inspiration from it, and we want to protect it. We want it to be around for future generations. Our tagline is "Because life is good," and that really is the motivation for us to do the work that we do to make sure that these amazing plant and animal species and some wild habitats are around for the sake of the animals, but also for future generations to understand and enjoy them.
The thing that I'm beginning to think, I'm a dreamer. I hope for a better world, and I work for that. I actually think there's going to be a turnaround. I think we're beginning to turn a corner here, and that once again, people are going to want to really come back to nature. We left it for a period of time. We just launched off into hyper-technology, and that's a fascinating zone. But I know I started out as a naturalist years ago in Minnesota when Yul Gibbons was writing about the wild asparagus, stalking the wild asparagus, and it was a book that was on the New York Times bestseller list. That it's been a long time since something like that has happened, but I personally think that people are going to, their soul is just going to demand that we re-embrace the importance and the significance of diversity. Let's talk about what the Center for Biological Diversity is doing to bring out your message and what you think is important for people to really take away from this conversation that they can begin to apply in their actual lives.
Well, like I said, our mission is to protect biodiversity and endangered species. We focus on recovering endangered species that are kind of indicator species of certain habitats, and we're very focused on protecting habitats for species because habitat loss is the number one cause of extinction, and no species can survive without its habitat intact. And we have a number of programs that we're working on. The probably most significant that we're working on right now is the climate issues, the global warming issues, and rapid climate change. And we're one of the groups that's working to force the Bush administration to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and air pollution to protect ecosystems. And you were talking about, a change coming. We had a fairly watershed event just in this last year. We petitioned to list the polar bear under the Endangered Species Act because of melting of its ice habitat and the ice pack that it needs to hunt and survive on. And the Bush administration was forced for the first time ever to scientifically acknowledge that global warming is occurring and that it's human-caused. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has now proposed listing the polar bear as either endangered or threatened under the Endangered Species Act. And that proposal is currently being reviewed, and they're taking public comments. I think that's one of those actions that we may look back, if we are successful in addressing climate change and reducing our carbon emissions. That may be one of the actions that we look back on and say that really turned the tide. And sometimes it takes the cute poster species to get people to care. But I think the polar bear has a big constituency out there of people who are paying attention and care what happens to it.
It's really important that these large, significant animals, which you refer to as charismatic megafauna, which is a wonderful term, really carry the message forward. And I think one of the important things for people to understand that for every animal and creature like that, there may be hundreds of others that we're not even aware of that are as well going the way of these creatures. And it's important for us to really expand our vision and our awareness to understand that the big creatures carry the message, but we really have to start looking at the ground and the earth and under the rocks and in the trees and the forests to realize that these trends are happening in all communities and habitats. Talk about some more of your work and some of the other animals and projects that you're working on.
Well, we other things we do is we work to protect desert ecosystems. Our group did start in the desert in the Southwest, so we're working to protect a lot of the public desert lands from abuses from off-road vehicle use, from cattle grazing, mining, etc. We have a forest program that's working to protect public forest lands and species that depend on them, such as the California spotted owl, the northern goshawk, the fisher in the Sierra Nevada, you know, species that are dependent on the few remaining old-growth forests we have left. And then we have an oceans program that's working to protect marine biodiversity, and we've pushed forward protection for a number of marine species, the orca, two populations of the orca, the beluga whale in Alaska, sea otters in Alaska, the northern right whale, and a number of other species. And then we also have a river campaign and focused on western rivers and working on restoring native fish and riparian corridors along along western rivers. And then finally, we have an urban wildlands program that's working to protect endangered species and open space and really quality of life at the interface between our urban areas and our wild areas. So, you know, for example, in San Diego, you know, there's the multi-species conservation plan that's going forward. There, you know, dozens and dozens of species being affected by urban sprawl. Also in the San Francisco Bay Area, Tejon Ranch is a good example where we've got a campaign to try to protect the Tejon Ranch as a state or national park because of its incredible biodiversity. And really anywhere where you've got, you know, urban sprawl pressures bumping up against the last remaining habitats for some of our endangered species.
Let's say that there was someone who just recently came into this arena. Suddenly they began to hear the messaging and hadn't been that aware of it. It wasn't part of their worldview. How can you help them really accelerate their knowledge base, and what should they be paying attention to that you think is important?
Well, I mean, the message I always give people is, you know, I'm often asked, you know, we advocate for a lot of the unloved and unknown species. That's kind of been our trademark. I mean, you know, beetles and butterflies and coral species and, you know, some very obscure species, but that are important nonetheless and that are indicative of you know, their decline is indicative of problems with the health of ecosystems. And people often ask, well, why should I care if, you know, one little subspecies of frog goes extinct or if that lizard is no longer around? And, you know, ultimately it gets down to, you know, it's a moral and a philosophical issue, which is, you know, we humans are responsible for the changes and the habitat degradation that is driving these species extinct, and I think we have an obligation to do everything we can to protect these species and prevent them from going extinct. But just on a selfish worldview, you know, these species are the canary in the coal mine, and you know, when something starts to happen, you know, for example, a third of the world's amphibian species are in danger of extinction, and the extinctions are happening incredibly quickly, and that should be cause for concern for us, and essentially, ultimately, we're in line for the same fate if we don't make sure we have a healthy functioning planet.
I'm going to encourage people to actually become amateur field biologists. There, and a lot of people who aren't doing that, if they open up their eyes and if they're walking around and they see some little creature, they might just decide to figure out what that creature is. You know, get out a field guide, find out about it, and then just start to track on what information is available about its lifestyle, what it eats, what it does, its habits, its mating habits, and quite honestly, you could spend the rest of your life researching about any individual creature, any species, and it would be absolutely fascinating. And I think once that door is opened, you begin to see the wider picture that all of these creatures are miraculously wonderful, majestic creatures in their own right, even though they're not giant and big and phenomenal. And that all by itself, particularly in your backyard, would help people to become appreciative of the wider picture.
Absolutely. I think, I mean, people really connect with animals, and there's a fascination. I mean, you know, not just animals that are interesting or beautiful, but you know, I think people have an innate connection to wildlife. And actually, on our website, we advocate for quite a number of endangered species, and some of them are pretty obscure or unknown, or you know, aren't the more popular ones that are turned into stuffed animals. But nonetheless, very important and very interesting. And I encourage people to go to our website, and we have a lot of good information about endangered species in the U.S. And certainly, people can find local species in their area that are imperiled and learn about them.
And we are talking with Jeff Miller, who is with the Center for Biological Diversity. Jeff, why don't you give that website?
Yeah, the website is www.biologicaldiversity.org.
Now, there's one interesting thing that I've come across. This actually is what caused me to give you a call. And that is the fact that when people go to that website, there's a unique feature that that I think a lot of people are going to find very interesting. And why don't you talk about that?
Well, we, starting just before Christmas, we started offering free endangered species ringtones. And people can go to our website and download the calls and sounds of endangered species and use it as their ringtone for their cell phone. And we've got a couple dozen rare and endangered owls from around the world, about a dozen North American frogs and toads, a couple marine mammals, which are really popular, the orca and the beluga whale. We've got a Mexican wolf and some South American birds. And we've got plans to add dozens more species in the future. But as far as we know, it's the only free endangered species ringtone website in existence.
Well, let me tell you something. I went to the website. I had some of these, quite a number of them, as a matter of fact, sent to me through the website, and I have them now available on my phone. And here's what's really fun, and that is that when someone calls me now, they may hear an orca whale sounding in my, you know, they just hear it in their environment. And I'm sure a lot of people are going to go, what in the world is that? And that's the question that you want them to ask.
Exactly.
This is the wake-up call.
Exactly. It's one thing to tell people about endangered species or have them go read about it at your website or, you know, to give them the numbers about how, you know, how many species are endangered. But it's another thing if people actually hear the sound of the animal. I think it's going to catch people's attention. It's going to get people's interest. And if you go to the website, you can also download fact sheets about each of the species. And then also, with just a couple clicks, you can get involved in protecting the in our initiatives to protect those very species.
It's a great idea. I have about 10 on my cell phone, and every day I can change it depending on my own particular mood. And I'm just waiting, actually, to head out into the world here and have my cell phone go off. And then I get a chance, when people say, what is that, to talk about it. It's an opening that we otherwise perhaps don't have. It's a great idea. Really, really a great idea. I commend you for that.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, it's also been very popular. I think we've had 24,000 people download the ringtone so far, and the orca is far and away the most popular, but there are some Southern California species on there. People want to, and actually, you can either get that off our website, biologicaldiversity.org, or you can go to rareearthtones.org, which is a little easier to remember for the ringtone.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the Center for Biological Diversity, are there events that they can look forward to in the upcoming months?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you go on our website, you can join. You can get involved in volunteer events. You can get on our action alert list, which basically when there's issues or comment periods or, you know, we need letters written or people to come to a hearing on endangered species issues, you'll get an email from us. There's also some information for kids on endangered species and on, you know, educational materials.
Well, it's a huge topic, and we can barely touch the surface here. At some point here, we'll contact you again and do an in-depth show. I love to do that, really go into these topics in depth. But at this point, it's a teaser here, and I encourage people to go to the website. Jeff, why don't you give that website again?
The Biological Diversity website is biologicaldiversity.org, and for the ringtones, the wildlife ringtones, it's rareearthtones.org.
We're talking with Jeff Miller, who's with the Center for Biological Diversity. I wish you great success in all that you do and all the people in your organization. It's fascinating. I want to thank you, Jeff, for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much, Sydney.
So each of us must decide where we fit in this grand play of life. Are we an actor, a lead, a stand-in, or an extra? Are we saying our words, or writing the script, directing the action? Are we a critic or a patron? Or maybe we never even get in line. I always like to know that everything that I am was born in truth in the heat and cauldron of a distant star. that in some spectacular moment exploded into an infinitum starbits that traveled through time and space and finally came all together on this little planet Earth. We are all the stuff of stars. The question is, what do we choose to do with it? This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Thursday or any time on the archives when your voice of the Earth rings out around the world here on the Wild Side News.
Oh, my God.